Well, thank you all very much for coming this evening. It's wonderful to see another big audience for the Miliband Lecture Series. And it's a particular pleasure for me this evening to introduce Bob Goodin, who's come all the way from the ANU, the Australian National University, for this particular lecture. And we are delighted to have you here. And thank you for making the long journey. It always seems to me it tests the idea of globalization, that journey, because it feels like a long way. It doesn't feel like a... Yeah. Well, let me just say a few words about Bob by way of an introduction. I won't go through his CV at any length because it's so impressive. I'd still be here in an hour's time talking to you. And if I even try and read out all the titles of his books, it would take at least longer than you have patience for this evening. So let me just start by saying that he's American by birth. He studied in Oxford, where he completed a DPhil in 1974. Bob then spent 10 years at the University of Essex before making a shrewd move in 1989, more about that in a moment, to the Australian National University, where he's now joint professor of social and political theory and of philosophy in the Research School of the Social Sciences. I say it's a shrewd move because it's a remarkable job, as many of the jobs are at the ANU, high on research opportunities and rather low on the other sorts of responsibilities that the rest of us in academia do on a routine basis, but he certainly used the time well, as you'll see in a moment. He served as an editor of a number of journals. He was sometime co-editor of the British Journal of Political Science and a longtime associate editor of Ethics. He is now founding editor of the Journal of Political Philosophy, which, if you haven't seen it, you should look at it. It's one of the most remarkable journals in the field, if not the most remarkable journal in the field, with already a very distinguished record. He has written an amazing number of books, as I've already hinted. In fact, I think most of us who are academics here would say you've certainly been a rate buster. These are books in a variety of interlocking areas: political theory, public policy, and applied ethics. Let me just give you a flavor of them. Protecting the Vulnerable, which was published by the University of Chicago Press in 1985. Reasons for Welfare, Princeton University Press, 1988, jumping a bit. Green Political Theory, Polity Press, excellent publisher, good choice, private joke, 1992. Social Welfare and Individual Responsibility, Cambridge University Press, 1998. The Real Worlds of Welfare Capitalism, Cambridge University Press, 1999. And about to be published, or in the autumn, by OUP, Reflective Democracy. If that isn't enough, he's the editor of a big series of Oxford handbooks of political science for OUP, not one, not two, but the general editor of 12 forthcoming volumes, the Oxford Handbooks of Political Science. He's currently working on problems in democratic theory and on ways of conceptualizing and measuring autonomy, and we'll move on soon from that to the projects on constitutional design and apparently a more empirical study of the reflective voter. Is that us? Yeah, more or less.
One hopes.
One hopes. We hope so too. And we welcome him today to give the third in the Miliband series on global economic governance, and his title this evening is Global Justice. So please extend a warm welcome to Bob.
Thank you very much, David. It's always embarrassing occasions like this. I'm glad that that you mitigated my embarrassment by plugging your own private limited corporation. Where I now come from, political correctness requires us to commence occasions such as this by paying tribute to the traditional owners of the place. So I am pleased to pay my deepest respects to the traditional owners of this place, which are, of course, the economists. It's a particular pleasure to do so because calling them the traditional owners of the place, of course, carries with it the unspoken implication that they own this place no more. And that's a nice thought, too, in this connection. Economists, with notable exceptions, many at this place, have had a pernicious influence all around the world of late. The reason is their constitutional incapacity to keep their markets in their place under proper political control. I'm reminded of that wonderful passage in Tom Wolfe's book, The Right Stuff, where John Glenn turns to his fellow aspiring astronauts and lectures them on the importance of keeping their peckers in their pants. One wishes that there had been a similar lecture incorporated into the Chicago economics curriculum. With or without the lecture, though, even Chicago economists know that you can only market some things on condition that other things aren't marketed. You know, there's no point buying the title to property, for example, if it's cheaper to buy the judges and the policemen charged with enforcing titles to property. Now, in recent years, the World Bank has been railing most usefully against corruption. It's been extolling the virtues of a strong state in that sense as a necessary concomitant of the market. But there remains far too little appreciation in that quarter of the need to make sure that other things besides just public officials aren't bought and sold. It's not just a matter of preventing the buying and selling of people, though sure enough the slavery conventions could do with a bit more enforcement in some places. More fundamentally, it's a matter of preventing the buying and selling of things dear to people. It's a matter of preventing the corrosive influence of the market from diminishing the value of things in the process of allocating them efficiently. In our personal lives, each of us tries to keep certain spheres safely sequestered from crass commercial considerations. Richard Titmus's favorite example was the gift of blood donation. So too do we as a nation try to keep some of our fundamental collective decisions safely sequestered from undue influence from other people's decisions. Different people, different peoples value the opportunity to do things differently. And that's precisely what old-fashioned trade barriers used to buy them. Now, that capacity to do things differently here from elsewhere is what is now being threatened by the collapse of those trade barriers and rampant globalization. Or anyway, so our economists allege. Now, I'm no expert on international economics, but I'm not sure you have to be to know that the bolder claims of globalization theorists have just got to be wrong. Simple experiments are the most telling. Here's the best example I know. Think back to, sometime in the 1980s, I suppose, when the space shuttle Challenger fell out of the sky. Great national tragedy, great hoo-ha, commission of inquiry was convened, held hearings, NASA official called to testify. And the commission asked, well, look, I mean, is it possible that those, typical freezing conditions the night before the launch might have frozen the rubber bits, those O-ring thingos that connected the bits of the rocket, and those cracked, and that's why the whole thing came crashing down. NASA officials said, well, don't know. We haven't done the experiments yet. You've got to give us time. Now, at this point, Richard Feynman, Nobel laureate in physics, certainly the funniest man on the Commission of Inquiry, and probably the smartest, said, allow me. He reached across to the witness table, picked up that sample O-ring material that NASA brought with him, plopped it in his iced water. This is America, after all. Every commission has iced water in front of him. Hold it there for a minute or two, smacks it on the table in front of him. Thing shattered to pieces. With it, shattered the reputation of NASA for years to come. Right? Now, the corresponding globalization experiment that I commend to you is this. Go home, open up your closet, take out your shirts. Look at the tags. If globalization is true, why don't they all say made in China? Right? If globalization is true, why don't any of them say made in Burkina Faso, where the unit labor costs are so much cheaper? Okay, so you're stubborn. Yeah. Okay, take yourself off to the kitchen. Turn upside down your five favorite kitchen appliances. Globalization is true. Why do any of them say made in Germany, where unit labor costs are so high? Right? Yeah. Okay, I mean, at this point, the globalizationists will be left, spluttering, saying, it's more complicated than that, it's unfair. And, just like the NASA officials when Feynman pulled the trick on them. Let's just leave it there. Let's just leave them stewing. For the remainder of this lecture, having, put a bit of a question mark in place, I'm going to take the ostensible facts of globalization as read. Going to assume that everything globalizationists say is absolutely true. For the sake of argument, let's assume the world really is just one big marketplace, characterized by frictionless factor mobility, perfectly free trade, perfectly interchangeable commodities. Let's assume it's like that. I doubt that's completely true. I suspect it's not even remotely true, but let's assume it is. What would follow? In asking that question, I speak as a moral philosopher. My concern is with what difference globalization would make to the theory and practice of social morality. Is it good news or bad morally? That, in turn, resolves itself into two questions, in principle quite separate from one another. One, the in principle question, how would globalization sit with the basic structure of morality? Is it possible even in principle for globalization to be morally good news? And second, the in practice question. Even if it's in principle possible, is there any way actually to turn globalization to the service of moral causes? Well, principles, of course, are the stock in trade of moral philosophers like me. But moral philosophers ignore issues of practice very much at their peril. Moral choice, like any choice, represents the confluence of desirability considerations and feasibility considerations. If there's no way to implement something, however desirable it might be, it's just pie in the sky. So I commend to my fellow moral philosophers the proposition that institutional designers so cherish, that mechanisms matter. And toward that end, I'll finish this lecture with a bit of a laundry list of mechanisms we might use to turn globalization to moral advantage. But before moving to ways and means, let's speak some about ends. Now, speaking as a moral philosopher, the ends I have in view are ethical ends, matters of the right and the good. The question that worries me is whether, from the point of view of the right and the good, globalization might be good news. Now, at one level, the answer seems to me absolutely straightforward. If there are any truths of morality at all, then surely they are universal, which is to say global truths. No doubt, morality contains all sorts of optional extras, and no doubt there are various equally good ways of filling out even a few of its more essential details. But at some suitable level of generality, the truths of morality must surely be the same everywhere. The truths of morality, if truths they be, surely are not indexed to time and place any more than are the truths of mathematics. You know, we don't say 2 plus 2 equals 4 around here. Neither do we say, you know, it's wrong to maim and murder people around here. Now, you know, I'm putting that universalist claim a bit baldly, and I'll come back to provide a bit of nuance shortly. But what I want to note first and most firmly is just this. If you take the traditional sort of view that I do, that morality is universal, then having a socioeconomic regime like globalization that has a similarly universal reach is at least potentially a good thing, too. Of course, you know, potentiality is one thing and actuality another, and globalization will actually be a good thing morally, just if, just because, just insofar as that universalizing socioeconomic regime can be made to track universal morality itself. And that's what people who worry about globalization worry about, and that's the sort of worry that I hope to assuage later. But for now, just notice that structural isomorphism itself. If you think of morality in universal terms, then other social forces that operate in the same universalizing fashion should at least in principle be good news. Now, I've been putting the universal claims of morality a bit boldly up to this point. Let me just pause to assuage the ghost of Ernest Gellner, whose spirit still haunts this place. Let me assure you that I'm not trying to peddle some sort of monotheistic cult or some sort of philosophical foundationalism that, you know, is the academically respectable equivalent of that. What I say is, I hope, perfectly compatible with a constructivist understanding of morality. You just have to suppose that while morality is indeed socially conventional, what it's a socially constructed solution to is a set of problems that are faced by all societies and to which there really are a fairly limited number of socially stable solutions. Now, if that's true, if all that's true, then the problems of living together will drive everyone, everywhere, to broadly the same solutions, to socially construct broadly the same fundamental rules for themselves one place as another. Now, like I say, you know, different particulars are filled out in different ways in different places, but the basic rules are likely to be socially constructed pretty much the same, pretty much everywhere. Okay? The trick to finding the common core of universal morality is to pitch the description at a suitable level of generality. That's the trick that Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum, who I gather you've just been entertaining, and the World Bank following them, hope to pull off with their talk of capabilities. Different people in different places put their capabilities to different uses, but the same basic capabilities, you know, life, liberty, empowerment in various dimensions, are going to be necessary whatever particular uses you want to put them to. Okay, the same sort of trick that John Rawls pulled off more successfully than I think he subsequently realized with his talk of primary goods, things that are necessary preconditions, whatever else one might want to do. Now, all those are ways of showing how the good might be morally universal, the same for everyone, everywhere, despite the great diversity of particular goods that different people in different places might pursue. The same strategy can be used to show how the right might be morally universal, the same for everyone, everywhere, despite the diversity of particular rights and duties that are imposed on different people in different places. Henry Shue persuasively argues that rights to physical security and subsistence are basic rights in the same Rawlsian sense of being necessary preconditions for any other rights or duties the people might have. Security and subsistence are basic rights, Shue argues, because they're logically required to underwrite the agency, the human agency, that's presupposed by any of those other more specific rights. In these sorts of ways, I think we can, at some suitable level of generality, produce a list of human rights that has a credible claim to universal application. It's not just the old Roman jus gentium, a list of rights that all legal codes in the world happen to have in common. The trouble with that approach is as soon as some crazy state somewhere strikes one of these rights off the statute books in that jurisdiction, it falls off the jus gentium as well. What I have in mind is not just an overlapping consensus of that purely contingent sort. Instead, the universal rights derived in the way I've been talking about would be right regardless of whether everyone or in extremis anyone in the world actually currently respects them. Well, it's easy enough to persuade people of that, at least in part. Of course, there are always some obdurate postmodernists who refuse to accept any moral truths or any truths of any sort, but most people, by and large, will go along with the idea that there is at least a common core of minimal morality, the thou shalt not sort of morality, that does have universal application. Most people are prepared to believe that they ought not murder, maim, or torture people, whether or not they're one of us. At least most people were prepared to believe that until the mad aftermath of September 11th, but of that, the less said the better. Whether there are any positive duties, any positive obligations to help people who are not one of us, is often regarded as quite another matter. Common sense morality of a fairly unreflective sort always tends to assume that our duties to provide positive assistance to people really depends on their having some sort of special relationship to us. And that people who don't have any sort of special relationship to us, foreigners and people like that, strangers, at most are entitled to that moral minimalism of thou shalt not morality. Philosophers are famous for crazy examples. Here's one of the crazier. Suppose your house is on fire. Suppose two people are trapped inside. One of them is Archbishop Fenelon, great benefactor of mankind, wonderful character, a lot of life in him still, a lot of good yet to be done. He's one. The other one is your own mother, Now, common sense morality in this crazy case says, hands down, mom wins, right? It would just be indecent, according to common sense morality, to even think of going saving Archbishop Fenelon, great benefactor to the human race, though he may be, in preference to your own mother. Special ties trump the claims of universal, impartial, impersonal morality. Now, utilitarian philosophers rail mightily against that conclusion. What magic is there in the pronoun my that should justify us in overturning the dictates of impartial reason, roared William Godwin, 18th century utilitarian anarchist, partner of Mary Wollstonecraft, father of Mary Shelley, and in that way grandfather of Frankenstein. But rail though utilitarians do, common sense morality remains damn firm in the conclusion that special relationships matter more than impersonal morality in these matters, and by extension that fellow citizens ought to have more claim to our moral efforts than distant strangers. Now, of course, I'm on the side of Frankenstein here, right? Make no mistake about it, but it does no good for us universal cosmopolitan utilitarian moralists merely to rail. It does no good for us just to say, look, I just can't see what difference a tie of blood, you know, much less having the same color passport, should make in all this. The I don't see move constitutes an exposed argumentative chin that's just inviting the jab. You know, is that I don't see a confession or a criticism, right? So if we want to defend the claim that the demands of morality are at root universal, despite the superficial appearances to the contrary, then what we universalists have to do is to offer our critics some account of why those superficial appearances look otherwise. What sort of story can we tell to square our universalism with the firm common sense intuition that we owe people in special relationships to us, like mom, more by way of positive assistance than we do toward strangers, even very distinguished great benefactors to mankind, like Archbishop Fenelon? Well, I don't think it's all that hard to find a story to tell here. All that we moral universalists have to do is to point to the advantages of a moral division of labor. In morality, just as in the economy, specialization's got its advantages. More gets done, more good gets done, morally. When people concentrate on one thing, some doing one thing, some doing another, than when everybody tries to do everything at once. In the case of positive personal assistance here in view, the people who are closest at hand are usually the best suited to know what needs to be done and the most capable of acting efficaciously to do it. Now, if all that's true, then it obviously follows that moralists who are in principle universalists, like me, would in practice carve up the moral chores, assigning particular jobs to particular people, assigning in the process particular responsibility for taking care of particular people to particular other people, right? Typically to people who are proximate to them, or close to them. Now that's going to give rise to a morality of special relationships within families, within nations, and whatnot. The superficial structure of morality is going to seem particularist. It's going to allow, and it's going to require us to give favoritism toward those who are known and near to us over distant strangers. But the deep structure of morality is going to remain universalist through and through. And that deep structure actually matters. Right? And here's why. If the superficial particularism went all the way down, if there was nothing under it except special relationships, then we would never have any reason to provide positive assistance to anyone who is not one of us, who is not connected by a special relationship. All that we would ever owe people who are not one of us are the negative duties of thou shalt not moral minimalism. And that's not going to be true, though, if the particularism rests merely on the surface of everyday morality. Suppose that the particularism is in fact underpinned, as I've been suggesting, by universal duties which have merely been assigned to particular people. then everyone's going to have at least a residual duty to make sure that those duties are discharged, those special duties are discharged, in the first instance by the particular people to whom they've been assigned, but failing that, by the moral community at large, acting through any of many sorts of agents. That's the fundamental premise of the law of refugees, for example. Whatever may be the ordinary priority that our fellow country folk deserve, if there are some people who, for whatever reason, stand outside that system of ordinary protection, people without a country or people whose fellow country folk can't or won't help them or indeed threaten to harm them, then a residual duty falls to the moral community at large to assist those people as if they were one of their own. That's the law of refugees from Grotius and before. Of course, that's a duty that falls on the whole moral community in the first instance. And if any country does it, then no other country needs to do it, and that invites strategic manipulation and buck passing and free riding. I mean, Australians know all about that these days. But that's just to say we need some mechanism for allocating those secondary residual duties just as we have for allocating the primary duties. So you know, we need some way of figuring out who's the next cab in rank when the people with the primary special responsibilities based on nationality or proximity or whatever fail to do their duties. My point simply is that when we look at special responsibilities toward mom or fellow countrymen or whatever as merely universal duties that have been assigned to particular people, then there remain these residual duties, universal in the first instance, to ensure that people to whom they've been assigned actually discharge them and actually to do something about it ourselves if they don't. Now, if I'm right in what I've been saying about the basic structure of morality in this respect, then it's not only refugees to whom we owe a duty of rescue. I mean, no doubt they've got special problems and special call on our attention. But what's special about them is not just that they happen to have washed up on our doorstep. What's special about them is surely that we have those residual duties that have been called upon but by virtue of the fact that the people who should have ordinary primary responsibility for these people can't or won't discharge them. And it's not just refugees who fall into that sort of situation. All sorts of people fall into that sort of situation. All sorts of people all over the third world find themselves in places where the people with primary responsibility, their national governments, can't or won't help them. And that calls into play the residual obligations of people in the first world to come up with the goods, to make good the residual responsibilities they have to take care of people who can't be taken care of or won't be taken care of by their own countries, their own national governments in the third world. So that's the sort of basic way that I suggest we should think of grounding the case for substantial international transfers first world to third. Now I'll return with some hopefully practical suggestions along those lines in just a minute, but let me just revisit the structure of globalization now and how it might impact on morality in the international sphere. Remember, I decomposed that question into two further ones, the in-principle question, the in-practice question. So far, I've been focusing on the in-principle question. I've been arguing that globalization might be a good thing morally, at least in principle, because its universalizing tendencies line up nicely with the universalism that lies at the heart of morality itself. Universalist cosmopolitan moralists like me say that at some suitable level of generality, the same rule should apply to everyone everywhere. Globalization, we're told, will have precisely that universalizing effect. In principle, it looks like a happy coincidence. Just how happy the coincidence turns out to be in practice is obviously going to depend on which rules globalization applies universally. The conventional wisdom and experience to date is that globalization tends to apply the rules of the market, and the unfettered market is all too often diametrically opposed in the rules it applies to the rules of true morality. whether that is necessarily so or whether there might be some room for moral maneuver here is the in practice question to which I now turn. Well, first some diagnostics. What worries us about globalization is that it deprives us of our old familiar ways of pursuing social justice. Universalist and cosmopolitan though their moral principles may be, in practice most campaigners for social justice, a few honorable exceptions apart, have tended to pursue social justice one country at a time. Right? They do so apologetically. They defend concentrating on justice at home in their own country and letting global justice take care of itself more as a matter of prudence than principle. Yeah? We all know how hard it is to achieve social justice even in one country. If we had to achieve social justice everywhere in order to achieve it anywhere, then we'd just give up the game. We just would give it up as an impossible task. That's how trade barriers were defended, ironically enough, by none other than John Maynard Keynes, writing a crazy little 1933 essay, quite out of character, on national self-sufficiency. Keynes wrote that we need to be as free as possible from interference from economic changes elsewhere in order to make our own favorite experiments toward the ideal social republic in the future. And movement toward greater national self-sufficiency and economic isolation will make that task easier. Well, you can sure see how to make it easier to achieve more social justice at home. What I want to point out is that given certain assumptions which probably were true pretty much in Keynes' day, that might also have been a good strategy for promoting social justice worldwide. Call this a strategy of compartmentalized cosmopolitanism. Its basic approach is just this, basic rules. First, do as much good as you can at home. Right? Get as much social justice as you can at home. Second, do no harm abroad. Third, conclusion, just so long as the moral division of labor holds, so long as it works the way it's supposed to, doing as much good as you can at home and doing no harm abroad together means guarantees that you will maximize the amount of good that gets done across the world. Okay, that's the sort of thought. Now, of course, that appeal to the moral division of labor overlooks the caveat in the unspoken rider about backup residual responsibilities that I've just been belaboring. But the model of compartmentalized cosmopolitanism has further vulnerabilities all its own, which make it, I think, perhaps applicable in Keynes' day, but no longer in ours. The strategy of compartmentalized cosmopolitanism assumed, first of all, that those compartments are watertight, that nothing we do in pursuit of justice in our own country will impact positively or negatively on the pursuit of justice in any other country. In that case, but only in that case, pursuing maximal justice in each place would lead to maximal justice in every place. But that assumption of watertight compartments, true though it must have been in Keynes' day, I suppose, no longer is true. Cross-boundary spillovers are absolutely endemic, whether you're talking about political and moral and social affairs or whether you're talking about environmental and economic ones. Second assumption underwriting that model of compartmentalized cosmopolitanism was the thought that we can act more effectively at close quarters than we can at a distance. Our information's better, our networks are better, we can bring pressure to bear better, and so on. Again, maybe it was true in Keynes' day, ain't true no more. Most of us probably know more about what's happening in Paris and Brussels and Geneva than we know about what's happening in some medium-sized city a couple hundred kilometers away. Leeds. What do you know about Leeds? Yeah? Okay. Just as it's easier to have knowledge at a distance these days, so too is it easier to act at a distance. When Australian environmentalists were trying to stop the damming of a particularly beautiful Australian river in Tasmania. They found that it was easier to appeal to the UN World Heritage listing, and bring that apparatus to bear, than it was to appeal to the consciences of Tasmanian legislators. Well, maybe an unfair example, Tasmanian legislators are a particularly nasty breed, but you get the idea. I mean, the upshot is just that this cosmopolitanism of a compartmentalized sort, focusing on justice in one's own country and trusting international global justice to take care of itself, may once have been a viable strategy, but it isn't any longer. It's no longer morally permissible just to focus on your own country without any regard for transnational consequences, neither if globalization is true, and remember my question mark, is it practically possible to pursue very different policies one place from another. Now, the bad news from a moral point of view is that all the progress we've made domestically toward justice is now at risk of being swamped from abroad. If globalization is true, we can no longer have islands of justice in a sea of injustice. If globalization is true, we can no longer secure justice among ourselves without securing justice for everyone else in the world. That's the bad news, but from a moral point of view, hang about. I mean, is that really bad news at all? From the point of view of universal morality, at least, surely that should be good news of a sort. Globalization gives us, in the hackneyed courtroom formula, both the motive and the opportunity to actually pursue justice on a grander scale than we ever thought that we could before. Never thought we needed to. We just have to be a little bit more creative when it comes to that mechanism design issue. We just have to be a little bit more creative about what mechanisms we employ when it's no longer just a matter of winning the next general election at home. Okay? So what I want to do now is just to provide you with some illustrative suggestions about the mechanisms that we might use to pursue global justice. It's no more than a laundry list, no more than a sampler, a few possible mechanisms. No doubt there are others. No doubt many of the others are even better. This list is really just to get your creative juices going. So think first of one mechanism, international treaty regimes. Most familiar, historically the most influential mechanism of international social protection. We in the industrialized West tend nowadays to take the great gains of the International Labor Organization for granted. But in the poorer countries of the world, where sweatshops are as endemic as cholera, the ILO remains a force for great good. So too, come to that, does the World Health Organization, as we're increasingly coming to realize that the best way of improving people's health is by improving their standard of living across the board. The best inoculation against many of the diseases of poverty is an injection of hard, cold cash. And surprisingly enough, as you look to other international organizations, I mean, even those great holding companies of international capital, the World Bank and the OECD, have increasingly begun calling for raising the living standards of the very poorest as an aid to economic growth. Now, my interest here is not so much in those particular organizations as in the broad strategic option that they represent. What all those organizations have in common is they're all based on multilateral treaties among member states. Now, ordinarily, we tend to think of treaties as pretty flimsy things. I mean, reasons are obvious enough. I mean, treaties are acceded to by states who often stipulate reservations in signing the treaties, thereby exempting themselves from many of the more onerous and important obligations of the treaty. Or again, accession to a treaty is rarely irreversible. A state usually, not always, but usually can, just as long as it gives due notice, withdraw from the treaty regime. Self-styled political realists, therefore, tend to suppose that treaties are pretty weak chains for binding strong states hell-bent on misbehaving. But as usual, here, realpolitik analysts actually turn out to be pretty unrealistic. It's really pretty rare for states, once they're signed up to a treaty regime, to withdraw from it. This particular patch of U.S. history is really quite odd in that, as so many other respects. The reason states hesitate to withdraw from treaty regimes is that treaties, just like contracts, which are their domestic analogs, actually benefit all parties. Everybody gets something out of the treaty regime, and it's something that they can get only by being in and staying in that treaty regime. Furthermore, the longer you're in a relationship, the more intertwined your affairs become, and the harder it is to withdraw without cost, and so on. So even though it looks formally like treaty regimes really don't have all that much power over member states, the informal reality is they typically provide an awful lot of leverage. Notice, too, that treaty regimes often start small and grow. Here, just think of the EU, right? Started out as a pissant little European coal and steel community, after all. Fluffed around for 20 years, doing little more than worrying about, you know, labor mobility within the EEC. But, you know, before long, we're not quite there yet, but before long, you know, I hazard to predict that it's going to become, in reality, if not in name, the first transnational welfare state. I mean, yeah, just think about it, right? I mean, the magic word in EU speak is harmonization. Yeah? One of the things that's got to be harmonized to provide a level playing field for all those employers across the union are the social wage, you know, the benefits, the welfare benefits that firms don't have to pay because the states pay them. And so there's going to be a natural tendency of ratcheting up. You know, everybody, you know, more or less has child benefits, and so you force the last state or two that doesn't to have them, and then you start ratcheting up the levels, and you pick up a few other things, and you ratchet, you know, before long it works. Yeah? So you don't have to go for big treaties in the first instance, you can go for small treaties and let them grow. Okay? Well, that's option one, treaty regimes. Option two, transnational networks and non-government organizations. These are critters that live in the interstices of treaty regimes. The transnational networks are just, you know, fairly informal alliances among like-minded activists. Non-government organizations, as the name implies, are more formally organized, but basically they work the same way. Take the example of international human rights. The formal treaty regime provides the structure, you know, the UN Declaration, the covenants, various other regional-specific and topic-specific treaties. That's the institutional site at which all the activity occurs. But once the apparatus is in place, what really drives social change, what drives protection of human rights, is just networking among the activists. So the human rights activists in Kenya, say, don't have all that much power and influence over their own national government. But like Peer Gynt, they just, you know, go round about. You know, the guys in Kenya get on to the guys, their chums in Africa watch, and they get on to Amnesty International, and Amnesty International, you know, puts pressure to bear on whatever is the most pliable government in favor of Amnesty sort of causes, you know, Britain or Holland or Sweden or whatever, and that national government then puts pressure on the national government of Kenya, right? So the big loop, but you get there in the end. Same thing happens in campaigns for international environmental protection. You know, environmental NGOs, lobby corporations, selling them on the idea that that stopping pollution is actually good business in various respects, and then those corporations that have been sold on that idea lobby their governments and say, look, you know, we want to stop polluting ourselves, and we can't do it when our competitors aren't doing it, so let's have some legislation here, please. It works. Or again, you know, foreign NGOs work on American NGOs who work on Congress and influence the American government to stop doing nasty things in that foreign country's territory. You know, so, I mean, eventually you get yourself into, you know, the most incredible positions that, you know, Greenpeace activists get appointed as national government's official representatives on some closed-door negotiation that Greenpeace never could have gotten into as Greenpeace, but as the representative of Denmark, of course, they get in. Or, again, you get yourself into the position as Greenpeace, being so influential and having so much crucial knowledge on the issue, that some of these international treaties are actually written in Greenpeace offices. I mean, I'm confidently told by my brother-in-law, who knows about these things, that the BAMCO Convention on Transboundary Movement and Management of Hazardous Wastes was actually written in the Greenpeace office in London. Well, the same sort of strategies can be deployed in pursuit of social justice for the poor. The downtrodden can appeal over the heads of their national governments, who are unwilling or unable to help them, to the world community more generally. They can just make appeals to these networks of groups that are willing to bring pressure for the poor, and through some roundabout looping chain, actually have some serious effects, both locally and internationally and on the big governments of the world. Now, mere networks like mere treaties look pretty flimsy from a realpolitik perspective. I mean, non-governmental organizations, by definition, you know, don't have the clout of states. They don't have the power to reward and punish that states have. All they've got is the power to petition, to talk, to embarrass, to cajole. Right? Those look like pretty paltry powers. But before dismissing them entirely, remember that that's the principal mechanism by which business gets done among states themselves. You know, our image of international organizations like the UN being sites of stonewalling, mere talking shops, places where talk replaces and quite intentionally replaces doing. I mean, that may be true of a lot that goes on, but think of the things that actually do get done and ask yourself, you know, how do they get done? What's the mechanism? What are the techniques? The way they get done is by working things out over a fairly protracted period within webs of dialogue. Anyone who doubts it just needs to go to Geneva, where one of the major trading blocks that lobbies the World Trade Organization there takes its very name, the Boeuf Rouge Group, from the name of the restaurant where it holds its regular meetings. Right? States in the Boeuf Rouge Group know that talking counts. Yeah, we should listen. States resort to the, you know, unique state resources of threats and coercion only in extremis, and then often fairly ineffectually. More often, they just come to sort of informal understandings, tacit, substantially unenforceable in The Hague. You can't take anybody to the world court over them. And in those respects, the informal power of transnational networks and non-governmental organizations merely to cajole seems to be perfectly on a par with the way that states typically exercise their own power. The swaggering of realpolitik theoreticians notwithstanding. Two methods. A third, international taxes and transfers. More visionary, be working through formal mechanisms. Various international taxes and transfers have been proposed from time to time. Perhaps one of the more common are resource taxes in various guises. Underlying principle is deeply appealing. As Locke said, you know, God gave the earth to mankind in common. And what he should have gone on to say but didn't is that nature's bounty therefore should belong to mankind as a whole, to the world at large, rather than to the particular people who had the audacity to plop themselves down on a place and say, it's mine. But appealing though the principle is, in practice, resource tax is usually dead in the water. The winners and losers can see too clearly who they are, what they're going to lose, and have too much power to do something about it. So, you know, when you're thinking about something like an energy tax, forget it. You know, the Texas oil men know exactly how much they're going to lose, and they, you know, simply go and chat up their least successful member, who now sits in the White House, and talked W into backing off, and so too do the coal men in Australia, and you know, a whole gaggle of immoral characters all around the world form a coalition to stop resource taxes. There's no hope. Politically, the only remotely hopeful way of running a resource tax is to impose a tax on resources that are as yet unowned by anybody. Various ideas along that line, I mean, things that might be taxed that people mention from time to time are minerals on the deep seabed, wave bands for broadcasting and communication, slots in geostationary orbits above the Earth, things like that. Nobody owns them yet. Valuable resources. The idea here would be to assign property rights in those things to, say, some agency of the United Nations, which then leases those things to, for a pretty penny, to the highest bidder, and redistributes the proceeds to the poor of the world. Well, it's a nice idea. Some people may suppose that even seizing property that nobody owns is more than the UN is up to these days, and they may be right. So I won't belabor these proposals. I'll just skip to my favorite. My favorite is the transnational tax that I think actually is, or should be, politically the easiest to sell, and that's the Tobin tax. The problem to which the Tobin tax was originally a solution, remember, was all those petrol dollars sloshing around, wrecking havoc as they went from one nation to another in the wake of the oil crisis, OPEC's great success. It's been resurrected recently as a solution to the problem of currency speculators taking their money out of one place and putting it into another at great rates, trying to chase a quick buck. Tobin's idea, as he put it, was to put a little sand in the wheels of international finance. The idea was just to levy a pretty small tax every time you converted money from one currency to another. Tobin's calculation was that even a pretty tiny tax would be enough to wipe out the speculative gain that drives all of this, you know, mad frenzy of money from one place to another, wrecking the international financial system and national economies along the way. The Tobin tax would incidentally generate one hell of a lot of tax revenues. Right? But those revenues really are wholly incidental. Right? The benefits to the international financial system derive purely from the tax being collected and not at all from how the tax monies are spent. You know, you can give it to the poor, or you can give it to the UN, yeah, or you can burn it or dump it in the ocean. I mean, the benefits to the international financial system are the same whatever you do with the stuff. Now that creates a wonderfully win-win situation. The rich countries of the first world are going to be the primary beneficiaries of having the Tobin tax imposed and collected. A British audience doesn't need to be reminded of the pernicious effects on the national economy of the Zurich gnomes for people of a certain age, or George Soros for people of a certain other age. The poor countries of the world, on the other hand, are the ones most likely to benefit from how the money is going to be spent on just about all the current proposals for how to spend it. The most formally pro-poor was the proposal of the Copenhagen Social Development Summit. But all the other ways we've thought of spending the money, you know, actually, as it happens, you're going to benefit countries that happen to be pretty poor. I mean, peacekeeping operations was another idea of how to spend the money. A lot of the nastiest peacekeeping jobs actually come up in some of the poorest countries in the world. At least they're pretty poor by the time the white hats get there after years of civil war. Or again, sustainable development was another idea, but again, sustainable development is largely talking about spending money in very poor countries of the world. So, you know, pretty much however you spend the money on any of the proposals that we have on the table anyway, third world is going to benefit largely from the expenditure. So on the face of it, it looks like you can mobilize a coalition of both the first world and the third in favor of a Tobin tax. One other fascinating feature of a Tobin tax: some international mechanisms work only if you get every country in the world more or less on side. In those cases, looks like a no-hoper. You know, it's really hard to get everybody on side. Coordination is just impossible. There are other cases, other mechanisms, however, that work with substantially fewer of the key players on side. So, you know, George Kennan, you know, 1970s somewhere, suggested that with international environmental protection, it really doesn't, you don't need a global pact. What you need are the 20 dirtiest, richest countries to agree to cut back pollution. And if they keep the agreement to cut back pollution, pollution essentially, you know, is reduced by, you know, several orders of magnitude worldwide. And frankly, it doesn't matter what the rest of the world does. Right? It just doesn't matter. That sort of intuition was written into the rules that governed when the 1987 Montreal Protocol preventing ozone depletion came into effect. Not a fixed number of countries, which is, you know, the usual rule on this, but rather weighted according to how important the countries were in generating ozone depleting gases. Well, the same sort of thing, I think, can work with the Tobin tax. Doesn't have to be implemented by absolutely everybody. If you just had the top 20 trading nations in the world on side, then you're home and hosed. Of course, people could always keep their money in baht or, you know, zloty or escudos or pesos, but, you know, the risks of holding dodgy currencies, you know, are going to be sufficient to concentrate the mind and force most of the money to stick in countries in the Tobin tax regime. Well, those are just three sample mechanisms we might use. There are going to be others you can think of. I challenge you to do it. I just want to reassure you that, you know, there are plenty of good ways of globalizing justice at the same time as globalizing everything else. Well, let me close by recalling an early petition against globalization of a different sort. The French satirist Bastiat, writing in 1846, has the manufacturers of candles, lanterns, tapers, etc., appealing to the French Chamber of Deputies for relief in these terms. "Sirs, we are suffering from ruinous competition of a foreign rival who apparently works under conditions so far superior to our own for the production of light that he is flooding the domestic market with it at an incredibly low price. The moment he appears, our sales cease, all consumers turn to him, and a branch of French industry is all at once reduced to complete stagnation. This rival is none other than the sun. We ask you to be so good as to pass a law requiring the closing of all windows, dormers, skylights, inside and outside shutters, curtains, casements, in short, all openings through which the light of the sun is wont to enter houses to the detriment of our fair industries." Well, if theorists of globalization are correct, and remember I have a question mark over that, but if they're correct, then it would be just as pointless to appeal for a return to the days of trade barriers and currency controls. The world in which nations are economically autonomous and have a free hand to pursue social policies completely of their own choosing is, if they're right, gone forever. If globalization is so right, then it's a sad day indeed for social justice in the sense that all of our hard-won domestic gains will be undone. But campaigners for social justice take heart. As a matter of principle, principles of social justice are properly seen as global in scope. As a matter of political practice, globalizing justice in any of the three ways I've been discussing, or maybe dozens more, should be seen as a perfectly feasible ambition. The old socialist ambition used to be to capture the commanding heights, by which they meant the political command center from which a country's economy could be controlled. Globalization theorists tell us there are no commanding heights anymore. No global state capable of controlling global markets, no political steering capacity, no wheel, no rudder. Well, my suggestion is, yeah, let's just update that metaphor. I mean, after all, steering by rudders is pretty old tech, isn't it? You know, let's take seriously the thought the global economy operates in a political vacuum, And let's think some about how we actually steer ships through a vacuum in space, right? Blast of air here, blast of air there, you know, the ship goes just where we want it. Campaigners for social justice take heart. Hot air is what we're good at.
Well, there's certainly time for questions. We have a tradition in this series of taking clusters of questions. That'll depend on some of my colleagues who are political philosophers not being too elaborate in their questions. But I would certainly like to hear from them about their reflections on the deep structure of morality that underpins this argument and on other related issues. But the floor is now open, and we can take, let's take two or three questions to begin with. So where shall we start? Question over there. If you could just indicate to me if you would like to ask a question, that would be all.
That's really a pretty good lecture, Professor Robert Godin. Yeah. So I would like to bring you to attention two issues. First one is about the refugees. See, why is that? How would you justify your government's action of forcibly resettling those Afghans into the small Pacific islands? Human rights, a good solicitor or anybody can litigate your government in international court. The other thing is about the Commonwealth issue. Recently, the Zimbabwean. If the Justice for Robert Mugabe is suspended, immediate suspension from Commonwealth, poor Mugabe. Is there a way that you people like you could give an opportunity for the masses of Middle East at least to have a mock elections? Thank you.
Right. Further questions? Now they're beginning to roll. Thank you. Good. Please. There's a mic that's just coming to you. I've noticed none of my political philosopher colleagues have yet raised their fingers, but you will have to ask a question. You're under great pressure. Please.
Well, I'm quite offended I'm not a political philosopher colleague yet.
A budding one.
Thank you. Your deep structure of morality, as I could tell, was based on this notion of residual duty. And I'm not quite sure that this is a sufficient way of pursuing globalized justice. That if this residual duty flows from states that, for whatever reason, cannot or will not help their citizens, then I think this notion of duty doesn't sufficiently give us a way of evaluating the practices of states which might produce these populations of people. States may, for very morally indefensible reasons, be in a position where they will not help their citizens. And this notion of duty alone, I think, doesn't sufficiently justify our intervention in states like that, globally, internationally, cross-culturally.
Thank you. Yeah, why not? Next. Yeah.
It seems to me that a lot of your argument is, I mean, at least the beginning was based on this idea of common sense, and I mean, I would contend that common sense is actually something descriptive and not causal or not. I mean, it's not a justification. I mean, it's something. It's a sense we share in common, and not more and not less than that. And so, I mean, I wanted to ask you whether what we should be doing is rather than sort of lament the fact that we all have these special relations and particular affinities, and sort of somehow overcome that by referring back, as you do, to some universal human nature. Why don't we just actually try and expand that realm of close relations and just sort of build something on the particular? But basically that.
Couple more, Chris. Thank you. At least going to earn your dinner now. Excellent. And my colleagues over here still have to earn theirs. Dinner now depends on it.
Mine's a kind of IR question rather than a philosophy question, which is about the nature of globalization. You seem to be working on the assumption that you either have a kind of frictionless, totally globalized world, or you have watertight compartments. And you've got a political philosophy and notion of justice that goes with one or with the other, whereas it seems to me what we've actually got is neither of those two positions. What we've got is a kind of partially globalized world in which some things working out at global levels, whereas the capacity for nation states to govern themselves in some areas is still quite strong. So I'm not sure whether the basic contrast you're proposing actually is not dramatically premature in terms of where we are currently in global trends.
We'll just take one more if that's okay, and then let the audience rest a moment. And Patrick.
Yeah, my point is just like Chris's, that you're underestimating the power of the laggard and the power of the remnant, basically. And these two things may in time diminish away and erode away, but time is very, very critical. And it may be a hell of a long time, centuries. So, you know, you've got to get out of being a political philosopher and start becoming more of a political scientist.
That's a worrying thought. Okay, over to you.
I moved from a department of political science 12 years ago into a philosophy department, and one of the great privileges in doing that is that you're not obliged to actually know any facts about the world anymore, so I appeal to the philosopher's excuse. I'll take these questions and answer them sort of randomly and miss out some of them, I'm sure, and with apologies, too many, I can't hold them all in my head, but back to front. Laggards and the residual can be a real pain for certain sort of purposes. I mean, the little story I was telling about how the Tobin tax works as long as we got the top 20 nations on board is a little bit too simple, and it's a little bit too simple because of bloody Switzerland's, right? I mean, it's important to get the countries, the top 20 countries with sound currencies all on board. If there's one really sound currency that stands outside it, which dimes to donuts the Swiss are going to try to do, like they try to stand outside everything else, then that's a sort of safe haven for money, and the Tobin regime will be substantially weakened. Now, okay, I mean, sure, we've got the sort of gaming going on, and we have to do something about it. But it's the sort of gaming you have going on in any international negotiation. The international community knows how to bring pressure to bear. I mean, we pried the gold out of the Swiss, after all, didn't we? I mean, it takes a while, and you bring him to heel. So, that sort of laggard, remnant, partial globalization, I mean, yeah, it's going to be a problem. Not an insurmountable one, but a genuine one. Now, as for Chris's version of partial globalization, I mean, maybe that's sort of where you were going with it. But I guess I don't see how some of the mechanisms, anyway, I was talking about couldn't be used. I mean, Tobin tax, for example, NGOs, for example, couldn't be used even in a partially globalized world on that part of the world that's globalized, and insofar as we all still naturally, inevitably, will also be working on our domestic legislatures and try to win domestic elections as well as bringing influence to bear internationally. I mean, it looks like we could pursue a two-track strategy that perfectly parallels the partially globalized structure of the world. So, unless you can tell me a story about how there's a dip in the middle and that a partially globalized world is impossible to get a hold of through either of the two strategies, one for the perfectly globalized world, one for the utterly non-globalized world. I guess two tracks is the answer that I'd offer you. The idea of common sense morality just being a crass report of unthinking prejudice is a description that I'd welcome, because remember, those guys were the guys who were against me. I was the Frankenstein to their motherhood and apple pie, right? I mean, they're the bad guys. They're the guys who say we have these special responsibilities, we should take them seriously. We don't have any analysis of why we should take them seriously. We just sort of have this common sense intuition that we should. I was the one who said, look, I'm a philosopher writing a theory here. I've got a comprehensive account of the structure of morality that is consequentialist, welfarist, damn it all, utilitarian. At root, I can tell you, what's right, what's wrong, why it's right, why it's wrong. I'm the one with the theory, they're the ones with the blind intuition. So I'm glad to have you on side saying, gosh, isn't that pathetic? Right on. You better believe it. But your particular suggestion that maybe what we should do, instead of making fun of their intuitions, is to try to expand the scope of people to whom we have special responsibilities. I mean, it's sort of tempting. I don't know quite how you do it. But I've had one go at it. I can't resist reporting it to an audience of this sort. My one go at it was a paper that I wrote with a couple of colleagues, Carol and Roy Pateman. And it looked at all those declarations of the rights of, you know, this, that, and the other, and asked the question, well, look, you know, why stop there? You know, I mean, why not extend it to the logical next step? Think about our fellow great apes, right? I mean, we're just one particular strand. We share 98.2% of our DNA with chimpanzees. You know, why not sort of extend it? And I've suggested this, and it's why it's so tempting to tell the story in this audience. Our particular proposal had to do with sovereignty. Why should we not? You know, sovereignty ain't what it used to be. I mean, we don't give sovereigns as much absolute power as we used to, and we don't expect as much from them as we used to, frankly. You know, so roughly speaking, if Serbs can be sovereign, why not the great apes? You know, why not carve out an enclave in Africa in their traditional homeland, make them sovereign rulers? Now, of course, you'll have to have somebody else patrolling the boundaries, I suppose, but I mean, that's, you know, not unheard of in the international system. So, it was only partially in jest. I mean, I can guess it was partially in jest. But, you know, it's not the sort of thing that I've gotten many calls to speak in favor of at the UN, for example. So I, you know, sympathetic though I am trying to extend our range of special relationships, you know, don't think it's possible. I can but apologize for my government's refugee policy, as you might have inferred. I'm not altogether in favor of it. It'd be fun to have mock elections all over the world. I'd sort of like real ones, if you don't mind too much, though.
Time for at least another round of questions, so let me just start with Robert Wade.
Thank you. You didn't actually say anything much about the content of justice. You did talk about mechanisms to achieve global justice, and you mentioned international organizations such as the ILO and the World Bank, and you mentioned, secondly, NGOs. And my worry is that in dismissing realists as unrealistic people, you are not paying attention to the distribution of power in your mechanisms, like the World Bank, like NGOs, such that a particular country's content of justice, such as the notion of the right of people affected by a development project to participate in forming the project, which is a very US right, that right is what is constituted as global justice, and a Chinese right, that is, that members of the party, members of the state, are the ones who have the right to be consulted about the impact of the project. That notion of a Chinese, the Chinese notion of participation, that notion never gets globalized because the channels of globalization are dominated by the United States. That's a consideration that seems to me entirely lacking from your argument.
Okay. Paul, could you want to take it as we go along, and then person in front of you afterwards?
Bob, you seem to be rather indifferent to the sort of foundational questions underlying your sort of utilitarian view. And so this can be constructivist, this can be manner of things. But clearly you've got an issue of motivation which you have to account for, which, you know, traditionally utilitarian theories provide in a way that doesn't necessarily get you to universalism. If you naturalize morality, for example, as most utilitarians do, you're stuck with the limitation of motivation, and then you end up with some of the considerations Patrick was talking about. Because globalization presents us with opportunities, it doesn't actually give us a motive for wanting to act on those opportunities in any particular way. And that's why the partialists have something on their side. Because in the end, you know, either through reciprocity or cooperation or because people are related to us, we just feel a stronger motivation to those like us in the relevant ways. And globalization, although it creates opportunities, doesn't necessarily change that.
Person in front here. Maybe. Yeah. Did you have a question? Not you, not you, okay. Ah, Keith,
over here. Well, it's the same question as Paul's, really. It's just that, you know, you, in sort of defense of crass common sense, probably your comprehensive theory is that only you hold it, or only you and a few others, and most people just operate with this crass intuition, common sense, and that, I think, connects with, as Paul said, with various other questions that have been asked.
Any more bids at this stage? Okay, thank you.
I think I've got an answer on motivation to you, which will catch both Keith and Paul. And that's, if David's right, big yeah, but if David's right, and if globalization is really... Given that David is right, yes, okay. Given that David is right.
I don't hold a theory of globalization that links it to economic integration at all, but that's a passing point which we can leave aside now. Go on.
If his mob is right, okay. And if you can't have different rules for yourself than anybody else, and that's a matter of, you know, just homogenization of rules being forced on us by you know, factor mobility, right? Then that means that if we're motivated, whatever we're motivated to do for ourselves, we have to do for everybody else in terms of, you know, imposing the same basic rules. We can't keep it to ourselves. We have to play by the same rules everywhere. Okay, and that's motivationally powerful, isn't it? I mean, it, insofar as what we want, what they want for themselves is the same as what we want for ourselves, and that's, you know, that's Robert's issue here. I mean, and fair enough. That's a big trick, and I kept saying throughout, you know, at some suitable level of generality, and you know, your example of the U.S. version of a right to be consulted and a Chinese version of a right to be consulted suggests that maybe, you know, the only level of generality at which it operates is a level of generality higher than anybody cares about the consequence. I mean, you know, that it's just so up in fairyland that it's of no material consequence to anybody, you know, and it's only the lower levels of generality that that actually, you know, any of us care about, and we can't play my games at that level. We have to actually negotiate. In terms of sheer power, insofar as it's that that's driving your concern, though, well, lots of little pipsqueak NGOs, you know, startups small with next to nothing, really, you know, look like they're still pretty undercapitalized, but still have one hell of a lot of power. I mean, you know, Greenpeace is a classic example, but, you know, it didn't, you know, it wasn't sponsored by any big national governments, and it still managed very nicely, thank you. I mean, Amnesty's another. So, sure, power matters. But, you know, you can acquire power by having good arguments and, you know, a lot of energy.
Stephen looks. Stephen, yeah, be ready for the microphone. And Paul, do you want to come back on this? No. Okay, Stephen looks. Anybody else before we close the range of questions?
Sorry, I didn't see it. So I just want to pursue you on this very last point, because I mean, I'm very sympathetic to conclusions, but worried about the way you get there. Well, you talked about the European Union, I was surprised, because you said here we have the European Union, and it looks as though it's heading towards a super welfare state, transnational welfare state. and you talked about rising levels of social, what did you say, social, you talked about the social charter and so on. I don't see it. I mean, that's not my picture of the way the European Union is going. It could be. I mean, your talk was very much, and I appreciated that, a sort of looking on the most optimistic side. I think we should do that as much as possible. But still, the motivational question seems to me really serious. In our welfare states, the problem of sustaining what you might call an egalitarian impetus is serious enough domestically. How can we suppose? I mean, what's the source of your optimism that it's got a future across states? It's really the same question I'm asking you again.
Any final considerations? All right, your last the chance to sum up.
That's my last sum up. Yeah. I'm not giving you guarantees that it has to go that way, Stephen. What I'm doing is suggesting that it doesn't have to go the other way. You know, that there is at least a possibility. There are mechanisms that, you know, if you get your hands on them and you twist them just right, you know, you don't have to give up hope. You know, it might work out. Now, you know, maybe the other side will see it coming and you know, throw some sand in the works, but it's possible. And you know, a lot of this discourse, you know, claims that it's not possible, and I'm just offering you a glimmer of hope. Yeah.
Right. Well, before we close, could I just remind you that the fourth lecture in this series is on May the 17th, after a good rest, at 12:30, if you could bear in mind, it's a lunchtime lecture, given by probably the most eminent American international relations theorist, Professor Robert Cohane, and he'll be talking about global governance and democratic accountability. That's on May the 17th. And then on June the 6th, John Ruggie, who's former political advisor to Kofi Annan, will be talking about global governance and corporate responsibility. So it just remains for me to wish you all good night and to thank Bob Gooden very much.